Welcome to the Junior NBA Coaches Corner with your host, Jay Billis. Today, Jay welcomes NBA coach Kenny Atkinson, youth and amateur officiating development lead from NBA Referee Operations, Gary Zielinski, and the Junior NBA Coach of the Year from Phoenix Basketball in Amarillo, Texas, Keila Doru. Now, here is your host, Jay Billis.
Welcome to Junior NBA Coaches Corner. Today's topic is going to be game management. Pretty expansive and wide, but should be a lot of fun. We've got three great guests with us for this podcast. Number one, we're starting out with Kenny Atkinson, the former head coach of the Brooklyn Nets, who I had the pleasure of watching work at the Nike Skills Academies many years ago, but played at Richmond. He was an outstanding player, played overseas professionally. Also coached overseas for a while before going with the Rockets, the Knicks, and the Hawks, and then taking over the Brooklyn Nets. And we're also, it's a pleasure to be joined by Keila Doru, the Junior NBA Coach of the Year. She's not only an outstanding seventh grade math teacher, but she coaches up to 10 basketball teams and has done an amazing job bringing up young players in the game, and want to congratulate her on being named Junior NBA Coach of the Year. And we also have with us Gary Zielinski, the longtime NBA official who has officiated over 1,100 regular season games. He's officiated both NBA games, WNBA, and is now the lead of NBA referee operations, especially with youth officiating development. I want to welcome all of you, and our topic is game management. And so I want to ask a very broad question first, and Kenny, we'll start with you. What does game management mean to you as a coach?
Yeah, no, Jay, first of all, thanks for having me on. And like you said, we go way back, and really enjoyed working at those Nike clinics. It really helped me develop as a coach. So being around great basketball minds like yourself, it was a wonderful experience. But game management, I mean, there's so many things to, think about. I think the first thing I think about, you know, with Gary being on the podcast is how you're dealing with the referees. And as soon as the referee assignments get called the day of the game, I look at them first and find out who is who's going to be refereeing the game and start thinking about the interactions that I'm going to have with the referees. If I know any of them personally, I think that's very important. I think that kind of starts it off. I think game management from a tactical standpoint, I had a great staff in Brooklyn. We had two or three coaches particularly assigned to special situations. A lot of that was analytics driven, quite honestly, whether it was a 2-for-1 situation, when we're going, when we're not going, out of bounds situations, under out of bounds situations with short clock, all that. So I would say those are the two main things I would think about.
Gary, for an official coming into a game, I mean, you talk about ultimate game management. The officials are in charge of managing the game and they're the law of the court. What do you think about as far as game management goes when you're going into a game between two teams?
So when we're going into a game, starting in the locker room, we talk about being fair. That's the main thing as a referee, is you want to be fair. Fair on the calls on both teams and so forth. So when we go into a game, we always go into it looking at it three different ways. We go, game comes first, your partners come second, and yourself comes third. So you always think of the game first. So whatever is good for the game is what we strive for. So that is going into the game. That's the first thing we think of, is the game comes first in any which way.
Keila, how about you? As a high school coach and dealing with younger players, what is game? And you don't have the kind of staff that an NBA coach is going to have. What does game management mean to you in the broadest sense?
My range of kids goes from kindergarten all the way up to high school. So it just kind of depends on what age group I'm with. I mainly work with my high schoolers, and with them, I think not only the refs, because we walk in and, you know, Amarillo's small, so they see a ref and they're like, oh my God, he hates me. So I think they feed a lot off of my energy is what sets the game tone. So if I'm positive and I'm encouraging and I'm uplifting, then they're going to have that same energy also. We've trained, we've worked through this, and we have become young women to where we know that, okay, I just got to push through this with a good attitude and be encouraging to our teammates so no one gets down on themselves. So we feed a lot off of each other's energy, and it starts with me.
Kenny, you know, to me, game management goes before the game starts. It goes to pregame scouting, preparation, all these different things. And you know, you mentioned something about an assistant and special situations. First, how do you divide responsibility among your staff for not only for preparation, but within game so that you have a consistent approach throughout?
Yeah, no, we have an assistant assigned to each one. I'll just kind of talk through them. You know, the first one would be, you know, we have to have a substitution pattern established before the game starts. And I'm not sure if every coach does that, but we have a spreadsheet prepared. And we obviously can change from that. And you know, it's up to me how I'm feeling the game. But we have a preset idea when we're substituting, how many minutes guys are playing, and that's really important, Jay. And managing minutes is a huge part, especially with, you know, 82 game schedule and understanding load management. So we have an assistant assigned to that. We have an assistant assigned to special situations. That was our video coordinator. So we'll meet before the game. We do about an hour meet and going over ATOs, end of game situations. And me and our video coordinator are very tight, to say the least. We spend a lot of time together working on that. Obviously, we prepare that in practice time too. But day of the game, we're also reviewing those situations. You know, our analytics person, we have an analytics coach behind the bench. So he was in charge of, you know, situated 2-for-1 situations when we're going. He'd yell at, hey, we had a call for it. 21 was the call. 21, 21. And boom, because I'm thinking of, you know, you're thinking of so many things during the game. So to have a coach assigned to that is really helpful. And then we had the coaches challenge this year. So we did not assign anybody to that. I think we came to the conclusion with the coaches challenges, it was my feel. And amazingly, Jay, what was really interesting about it, a lot of that was player driven. Like, you know, if Garrett Temple, you know, felt like he didn't foul a guy or there was a situation, I'd really listen to the players. And that was a really interesting dynamic, or really felt it myself. Now, we would have coaches yelling from the, you know, behind the bench, like, challenge it, you know, like, guys, you know, relax. There's too many opinions here. So they're looking up at the scoreboard. So Gary could probably expound on that a little more. But that was a really interesting tactical, you know, kind of situation. We had a coach specifically assigned to sideline out of bounds and under out of bounds. That was his specialty, and those are special. Those are important. You know, sideline out of bounds, probably 12 possessions a game. Under out of bounds, less. But I really like that. I really like that specialization. Surrounding yourself with experts, and you know, assigning them a task. You know, what's a coach from Liverpool, Jurgen Klopp? You brought in a throw-in coach. You know, it's become super specialized, and I really embrace that. I think it's super helpful. It helps me. We're talking about game management. You better have a staff around you that can help you with these things.
Keila, what do you do with regard to substitutions? Do you have a set rotation with your team or teams, or is it done more by feel based upon the game?
Well, it honestly just depends on the game. We go in with the substitution and how many minutes, okay, set aside minutes for each player. But then in like the closer games, if I'm a strong believer, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So if my girls are given 150% on that court, they're going to stay on that court until they get tired. And the thing is, the good thing about it is I have a good bench to turn to. So if I need to sub somebody out, I can just rotate them real quick, let them play. And if they're out there giving 150%, I won't make that sub again. I'm a strong believer in hard work.
How about with regard to foul trouble, Keela? What is your, I don't want to say what is your standard or policy, but if you got a player that gets an early foul trouble, are you one of those that likes to sit the player for the remainder of the half if you got two fouls, or how do you manage that? Is that more by feel too?
Yes, just based off of how I know my players. Like, there's one girl that if she gets two fouls early on in the game, she has to sit the rest of the half just because she already has that energy and she's going to go back out there with that same energy. But then I have a couple players that they could get two fouls. You can sit them, you can have a conversation with them, and then put them back out there and they will not foul the rest of the half. So it kind of just is about knowing my girls and what they're going to do with those two fouls or how they're going to move forward.
Kenny, what do you do with regard to foul difficulties with players, and how do you make those decisions?
Again, we have our analytics coach will give his opinion or what the numbers say on it. But we were extremely liberal, and we would not, you know, the two foul rule. I think that's kind of passe. We'd let guys get their third in the first half. And then we'd read this, you know, we'd get the advice of the analytics group, and then I'd make a decision on feel. But I think the kind of the old school way was like two fouls, boom, get them out of the game. But we would go three. I remember going four sometimes. Now, it depends who it is. It depends what your bench looks like. You know, there's a lot of nuance to it. But I think we'd err more on the side. I mean, most of the time guys don't, you know, Jay, guys don't foul out, you know, we're kind of very, very liberal with our in those situations.
You know, Gary, what's the division of responsibility for, an officiating crew? And in addition to that, does an officiating crew take into account before the game, the style of play they're likely to see? And the way the teams play so that the crew can be best prepared to officiate that particular game?
Yeah, to be a good referee, you really need to be a student of the game. That means how different teams, their style of play, different players, their style of play, how aggressive they are. You know, you really need to be a student of the game because you can't go out there just winging it. You can't go out there not knowing any of the styles and just blow your whistle, you know, the main thing I would say, Jay, is when we get into the locker room, we go over the videotapes of the team we're refereeing that night. We are studying everything they do, and hopefully we're ahead of it. Players are always ahead of the referees. We're trying to just narrow that gap.
And how about interactions with the – well, let me ask you first, going back to the – sort of the game situation thing. When I was asking about foul trouble before, as an officiating crew, do you feel you should be aware of the foul situation throughout the game? You know, how many team fouls there are for each team, or is it something you'd rather not know and you just want to check each time that a foul is committed as to whether, you know, they've crossed the line to the 1-on-1 or two shot fouls?
No, you definitely always need to know. We have a saying, say the consequences of your whistle. So you know when you blow your whistle, what's the consequences? Is it a second foul? Is it a third foul? I mean, if they foul, they foul. That's the rules of the game. But you need to know the consequences of your whistle. So you definitely need to know. We know if a player has one foul, we know, and like in Kenny's, what he said, sometimes he doesn't put him to the bench, but we know that second foul could put him to the bench. If they foul, they foul. We call the foul. If they get substituted, they have to. But yes, we definitely keep track.
And I want to, Gary, just with you, jump ahead for a second, because we're going to talk a little bit about this from a coaching standpoint, but from an official standpoint, when you get to the end of game, how aware of are you of you know, a team up three that's going to foul and to put the other team on the foul line so as not to get a three? And do they communicate that to you first? Is it better that they communicate that to you first so you're aware of it? How does that sort of game management go for an official?
Well, so we do have those situations. So if a player does come say, we are going to foul, well, our response is, well, then foul. You know, Kenny understands, you know, so our response is then foul, because we can't we can have one player saying we're going to foul and the rest of the team doesn't think they're going to foul. So they go up there to act like they're going to foul and we blow our whistle. We cannot do that. So we talk about every different scenario at the end of the game. And if a player does come up and say, look, we are going to foul, like I said, we say then foul. But we try to look at every different scenario.
And Kenny, what's your preference at the end of a game? Or when you're up three, other team has the ball. Most NBA teams are going to foul in that situation so as not to allow a three. But there's a way to do it and a time frame in which you want to do it. What's your philosophy and how did you do it?
Jay, this is the eternal question. I hear you guys on, you know, college, high school, it doesn't matter. I love these conversations, but yeah, we did have a set time on the shot clock. If it was below, I'm not going to give you that intel, but there was a set time. Under this time, we are going to foul. If it's over this time on the clock, we're not going to foul. So I knew the number. Again, there's always the feel part of it. Now, unfortunately, I kicking myself a little, how you foul, and you mentioned it, how you foul is important. And those are the things in the NBA you wish you had, more practice time, to practice those things. I know in college they do a good job of that, but there is a way to foul because, in the NBA, guys, if you're guarding a James Harden and you want to foul him, you better get him quick. You better get him before he gets into that shooting motion. So there's a lot of nuance involved. I will say having veterans and smart players on the court really help. They help you through these type of situations. But we do go over these situations in film work during the course of the season. Not only our own situations, but we'll take clips from other games and show them and say, hey, this is what we're, this is our, our team's rules in these situations.
Keila, how do you approach that with your teams as far as end of game situations? You clearly don't have as much, your players don't have as much experience, obviously, as college or pro players. But how do you communicate what to do when you may not have as much practice time? And does that include use of timeouts for you?
For the main part, it includes timeouts. Our practice time is very rare just because we have quite a few, about half of our team coming from out of town. They're 2 hours away. So we get to practice maybe once or twice a week. So when we do get up, it's like, okay, we've got to get this done specifically. So about end of the game time, we don't go over it too much, but in the time of need, I will use a timeout and set aside, okay, this is what we're going to do. If we're up and we have the ball, of course, we're spreading it out. We're stalling as much as possible just because we don't have a time clock at this age. And then if we're down, my girls are facing up. They are right there with their girls. I tell them all the time, I want to know what kind of toothpaste they brushed their teeth with this morning because you need to be that close to them and don't let them catch the ball. And if they do catch the ball, you foul them as soon as it, they get the ball in. So we do have a lot of, quirky sayings just to get my girls like, okay, now it's time. It's time. So.
How about your timeouts when you're, throughout the game, when your opponent is on a run, when do you decide to use a timeout? When do you decide, Keila, to let your players play through it?
Most of the time with my older girls, I let them play through it. If they go on an 8-0 run, that's only 4 baskets. So I let them figure it out on the court because they're older. They need to learn how to communicate. I'm not just teaching them basketball. I'm teaching them life skills. So if you're mad at your player, you better suck it up and get over it because we've got to come together as a team. So I will let them hang for a good 12, 14 points. And then if it's not fixed by then, I'll call a timeout and I'll give them that talk and remind them who we are, what we're here for, and why we're doing this and why we're working hard for it. And then after that talk, it's like they come out and they're completely different. And I'm like, why do I have to use a timeout? Y'all got to get this taken care of. So
I think that's an age-old problem on every level. how do you approach that, Kenny, as far as when you call a timeout, when an opponent's on a run
and when you decide to just let it go.
Yeah, no, I agree with letting them play through it. I really think that's important. I do think it gets to a point, if it gets to a kind of a ridiculous point, you need to call a timeout. Where I do like the early timeout is when you feel like your team is not focused and they've had effort breakdown or a tactical breakdown that you went over in pregame and you've been focusing on. And it might be an individual also. A guy's not hustling, didn't go for a loose ball. It might be 30 seconds into the game, Jay, but bang, timeout, get him in. And then you have to give him a wake up call. Those usually aren't the nice timeouts. Those are the ones where you kind of hit them hard, hit that individual player hard. And it's amazing. I agree. Like all of a sudden you'll see a quick bounce back. Oh man. But in the NBA, as you know, I think you have to be careful because teams go on runs. I mean, and it's such a long game. And if you trust your team and you go down 12-2, you say, we'll get back in this. And you wait for the mandatory timeout or the time to take your timeout. But that's another one, Jay. We do have a specific assistant assigned to, timeouts. And so I understand it all the time. How many times timeouts our team has and how many timeouts, the other coach has. So that's important. I'll get feedback from him. But again, it's another feel thing if you're going to kind of break those rules.
Yeah, it sounds like timeouts can also be a message to your team that if you let them play through it, that you're confident in your game plan. And,
sure.
Players make tough shots in your league. You're going to have players score over great defense at times. Do you feel like that's true, that's a message sending device too?
Absolutely. I think when you do that, you trust, you show you have a trust in your team. And I think players are like that, coach, calm down. I think you want to coach them up, right? Like, hey, time, and you build that trust with your players. And the other important thing is, and Gary knows this, I would say most NBA coach, like you want to save your timeouts, right? Like you want those, they're golden at the end of the game. It's so important to have your full allotment of timeouts for the end of the game. So I would say most coaches in the NBA should try to save them.
Gary, communication is always heralded as really important, not and obviously for coaches and players, but also for officials, that to communicate with the coaches, with the players on the floor. What's the best way to communicate with players and the best method so that you can manage the game as an official? And I would imagine that I've never officiated a game, but I would, even though I do it from the sidelines, I would imagine that dealing with player and coach emotions is a really, really difficult challenge.
Yeah. I say the number one thing dealing with 10 different personalities on the court and two different personalities as coaches is actually listen. Because if you listen to them, they're going to try to tell you what they feel is happening to them. If you try to always have the first word and the last word without listening, the communication is not there. So I find with any player, because there's so many different personalities, if you first listen to them, then you can try to correct what's going wrong, what they feel is wrong, going wrong, what a referee feels going wrong. You can try to correct that. But definitely listen is the very first thing.
What kind of interactions do you have, Gary, with players on the floor where you're communicating, talking, maybe during a stop action? Can you give us an example of effective communication between a player and official?
Well, with the players, you have your guards, you have your forwards, you have your centers. So you try to explain to what you're looking at as a referee in their position. So if they're a center in the middle of the basket and he's pushing too much, I would tell the player, look, you're pushing way too much. You got to use the standards that we allow to defend a player. So we mainly talk to them in their position, as a guard, as a forward. Now, if it's just the style of play, they feel they're getting physical, the defender's being too physical with them, then we tell them, hey, we'll definitely take a look at it because we're there to actually try to make it fair. And if they feel it's not fair, we'll communicate that with them.
Kenny, what kind of standard do you have for your players as far as dealing with officials? Do you talk with the players about their interactions or tell them, hey, listen, lay off the officials, stuff like that? Or is that on your level, you leave it to the player to make those decisions?
Jay, you'll love this, being a Duke guy, but I can't remember exactly, but I remember Coach K, showing Bobby Hurley, video clips of him complaining to the referee, and Bobby will probably love this story too, complaining to the referee. I don't know, it's 20 clips, right? And Bobby putting his hands on his head. So I stole that, I stole that strategy and have done it various times. I think it's your responsibility as a coach. When it crosses a certain line, the player has to become aware. And there's nothing better than showing on video. And you put the 20 clips in, you sit back and, you talk to the player, like, how does this look? We have a next play mentality. This is not a next play mentality. And it's, to me, and Gary might refute this, but I think it affects calls later on in the game. If you're constantly complaining, it's natural for a referee to say, man, this guy's been complaining all game. Maybe I won't give him this call. And I know technically that's not what the referee is supposed to do, but that happens. So absolutely, I think it's your responsibility as a coach to make your players aware when it crosses that line.
How do you deal with that, Keila, with your players as far as how they interact with officials?
I've actually been on both ends. For make extra money, I coach in the chapter here in Amarillo, and I also coach. So once I got into the chapter, I was like, oh my gosh, this is a whole different ballgame, which helped me adjust as a coach also, because I was one of those crazy coaches at one point. Then I was like, wait, I've been through this. I don't want to do this. So my players know from the jump, from when we first started season, you do not talk to the refs, because I've seen it, and like he said, it doesn't happen with all refs, but some refs take that the wrong way. And then you're like a target for the rest of the game. So my girls know, do not talk to the refs. They come to me emotional because I have girls. So, their emotions are crazy. They'll come to me, oh my gosh, she's pushing me. But then let me talk to the ref. I'll go over to him. We'll talk about it, whatever. But if it's like a situation where, because sometimes my girls can be soft, I'm like, you know what? Push through it. You're way stronger down there in the paint than anybody I've ever seen. You push through it, you get through it, and you go up strong no matter what. And, once they start doing that, I feel like you see the fouls more, because a lot of times my girls have these weak things where they're looking for the foul and they want to go up weak. No, you go up strong and it'll make the foul more obvious. So, but I set that standard. You don't talk to the refs. If you have a problem, you come talk to me and I'll go solve it, just because I have been on that other side of the perspective, and it is completely different being a ref and then being a coach. So,
Keila, how about parents? Because at the youth level, look, we all understand there's emotion that goes into these games. You see a call, you have an initial reaction. I don't think anybody has a problem with that. But when it crosses the line, how do you deal with parents of your players or family members of your players that you feel are crossing the line in the stands?
Well, again, a lot of our standards we set at the beginning of the year, just because in the past 2 years, we've learned a lot as far as what we're going to start with and how hard we're going to start. So like this year, we started way harder. So we have the players and the parents sign a contract. So if you get, it's kind of like a job, you get written up once. All right, that's your warning, whatever. You get written up twice, you'll face consequences like sitting out a game or something like that. And then this is for my players. And then 3 times, you miss a whole tournament. And then if it happens again, we hate to say it, but we remove you from the team, which we've never gotten that far. And then as far as parents, we highly recommend encouraging words. Like, because I let my parents know, if you think it's bad for you sitting on the sideline, it's even worse for the kids being on the court. But as adults, we have to lead by example. So in tough situations like that, be more encouraging than more negative. So I have great parents, God bless. I have wonderful parents. But with my younger teams just being at games and stuff, it is harder for them because I'm a mom of a 6-year-old. So if my baby gets pushed down, I'm like, ah, it's my baby, you know, it's turn up mode. So being, I sit on the sidelines because I try to make all of my team's games. And I'm just like, it's okay, calm down. The refs will handle it. The coaches will handle it. And about that time, coach is coming on the court like, hey, you've got to call that. So then they calm down because they see the level that our coaches have for our kids. You know, those kids are our kids. You may have given birth to them, but you trusted us with them. So they have become ours. And we will stand up for them the same way we would do our own kids. So I think since we set that tone, it helps out a lot.
Gary, look, I'm okay with people saying good call, bad call. That's the way it goes. If shot goes in, doesn't go in, good player, good coach, bad coach. We all talk about that stuff. So to me, good call, bad call is fine. But we see certainly in the youth level, it seems like more than ever that officials are hearing it in a way that does cross a line. How should officials best deal with that? It'd be nice if coaches and administrators would handle it, but how does an official best deal with it?
So what I try to tell officials in my new role with the youth and amateur officiating is I tell them treat it as the rule book states. The basketball rule book tells you everything that happens in the game and outside the game. If you have an unruly parent, and you're supposed to go get the administration. Me, I always try to tell administration, that's your job. If you have an unruly parent, you have to take care of that parent because it's actually in the rule book. What the rule book states is the referee should go get the administration and the administration takes care of that fan or parent. And if they have to remove them, they have to remove them. So I tell the referees that I try to train is, first of all, be nice. Just be nice. Because they can never come back and say, well, they said this to me and they said this to me. No, if you're just nice and follow the rule book and tell the parent, tell the administration, you don't even have to talk to the parent. Just tell the administration, please take care of this parent.
It's funny. I can't remember how many years ago I heard this, but it was the idea that every game for an official is an away game. Like you're dealing with the home crowd everywhere you go. And so you're going to get a certain level of vitriol, maybe if you want to call it that, from the home crowd, if it doesn't go their way. Are officials, especially youth officials, ever affected by crowds or by reactions they get? And if so, how can they best manage that? Like, how do you deal with that?
They're definitely affected by it because Jay, the youth basketball are usually officiated by lesser experienced officials. So they only have a couple years under their belt of officiating. So now they're just trying to officiate a game that's very hard to officiate because a youth level game is truthfully harder to referee than an NBA game. And the reason is because you have the rules and you have the spirit of the rules. In the NBA, we follow the rules. In a youth basketball game, you have the rules, but you also have the spirit of the rules. A player takes 2.5 steps. Legally, you only can take 2 steps, but the spirit of the rule is, okay, we allow 2.5 steps because we're not going to call that call all night long. So that's the spirit of the rule. So they're trying, poor referees that are doing youth basketball with the lesser experience are trying to referee this kind of basketball with parents screaming and yelling at them. And to them, the game looks like a scramble to them. You know, people that don't referee, Keila's refereed, she understands that it looks like a big scramble when you're trying to officiate youth basketball. Now you have parents and coaches screaming at you. Now it's total chaos. You're looking at total chaos and trying to control a game. And the first thing we tell the referee is you're in charge of player safety. But if you're looking at a game in total chaos and your prime objective is their safety, you're not going to have it. So like Keila says, when a player gets pushed, when a referee's looking at total chaos and there is a push and the safety's involved, the referee is not all there. So it definitely, with parents just don't understand and coaches don't understand what they're doing to a referee for the player's safety.
Yeah, it's a difficult position to be in. It's certainly the amount of respect I have for especially the, as you mentioned, Gary, the youth referees and the officials that do such a great job. I can't overstate that. And, you know, Keila, you've been involved with the junior NBA with coaching the Spurs organization teams. And you have so many resources available now through the junior NBA. And also, I wanted to ask Kenny, through eCoach, I've found that a tremendous resource just for me. I'm a subscriber, and I know you've been very active in it. And you you participated. You've done a bunch of these. I saw your floater video, and then you've also got one on finishing drills. And we want to take a look at that now.
Hi, this is Kenny Atkinson with the NBA Coaches and E-Coach. Here's a finishing warm-up drill we do every day with the Brooklyn Nets. It's called Touch It Up. So basically, this drill is working on using the backboard, different parts of the backboard, to finish over the defense. We're picking spots on the backboard, getting a feel for the ball, and changing the angle of our finishes. We can use both hands, switch to left. We have different release points, so I can release it at different points. Underhand, and again, just getting our touch, feeling the ball, feeling different angles of the backboard. Okay, RFK. That's great. We can also use different spins. As you notice, RFK is spinning the ball towards the rim. Good. Hit this one above the backboard, above the square. Good. Picking different spots, different angles, and different release points. Good. Switch to the left hand. Good. Off the backboard. Good. We can do the same thing on the other side. Start with my left hand. Again, trying to find different ways of finishing over those 7-footers that are in the NBA. Above the square. There we go, coach. To the side, go to the right hand, middle. One more make. Off the backboard. Good, RFK. Step in, touch it up. Good, good spin. Again, thinking about the big defender that's coming over that you have to finish on. It's not enough just to finish in the square all the time. Good. Great. One more. One more make. Good. That's good, RFK. Yep. Touch it up is a great way to warm up before you do your full-speed finishing drills. You can work on this alone in your backyard, in the gym by yourself, working on your finishes, touches, angles on the backboard, and release points.
Touch it up is such a great drill and a great idea. I remember hearing John Thompson III of George back when he was coaching at Georgetown would tell his players, I can get you within 4 feet of the basket, but the rest is going to be up to you. And even in their layup drills, layup lines, he would encourage creative finishes around the basket, not just the same rote thing over and over again, but be creative in how you finish. And Kenny, you know, how important has E-Coach been for young coaches to get those kind of drills when they can't get to other people's practices and can't go out on the road to find these things?
I'm a big fan, and I watch the other coaches in the NBA, and I've learned quite a bit and steal ideas from them all the time. And just as far as that touch it up drill, it's a real simple drill. It doesn't take any physical exertion, really, and you know, when the best players I watch, and I steal everything from the great players, whether it's Nash or Chris Paul or LeBron, they always start close to the basket when they come out for their pregame warm up. It's they start in close and then work their way back. And on top of that, let's face it, you know, points per possession wise, a rim shot it's the best shot in basketball. Everyone talks about threes and you know, off the dribble threes, but your ability to finish in the restricted area, it's a huge part of the game, and it's something you really need to work on, and you can really build out from that drill. And when I watch the great NBA players, it's not just your conventional layup. Like, that's not enough. You better know all the angles. You better be able to put it above the square. I've seen guys put it in the corner of the backboard and drop it in, you know, in playoff games, and something our guys worked on in Brooklyn. I think it's a nice warm up drill.
Well, it's great stuff. And before we let all of you go, I want to ask you a little quarantine question, a little fun here. One of the things with the extra time, I've had a chance to watch some things I never would have watched. I'm hooked on Yellowstone. I finished Ozark, and want to hear at least one thing from each one of you that you've watched that you might not have otherwise watched. Keel, let's start with you. What have you been watching?
That's a tough one. I actually started watching Raising Dion. It's on Netflix. It's really good. And then Flash. I don't know why I started watching that, but it's pretty good.
Gary, how about you?
I've been mostly watching documentaries on YouTube, all kinds of different documentaries. I find those fascinating. The stuff I never would have watched until now.
Anything stick out?
Well, the one I went to Dakar, Africa, to help the NBA Academy, and Gori Island, where the slave started. We went there and visited there. So I've come home and I've watched many documentaries about that. It's just fascinating.
Kenny, how about you?
All right, I'm gonna embarrass myself, and I'm gonna blame it on my wife. But Downton Abbey.
That's good.
It's unbelievable. Like I'm like hooked on it, and how the English aristocracy lived back in the day, and I don't know. The acting is amazing. I mean, the quality of acting, and obviously beautiful scenery. So it's something, you know, it's important to get something you and your wife can enjoy together. That's the one we found.
Yeah, my wife and I still haven't found anything we can watch together because I get too far ahead. We start it together and I shoot ahead, and apparently that's the same as cheating. But I don't think it is. I don't consider
it
that
is.
Cheating. Keel immediately takes my wife.
Yes, of course.
Well, thank you guys for being with us. It was a pleasure. Thanks for sharing all the knowledge. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jay.
Bye.
For more coaching resources, including our curriculum, please visit juniornba.com. I want to thank our friends at the NBA Coaches Association and eCoach for providing instructional content from their eCoach basketball video library to give our viewers an insider's perspective about how NBA coaches teach the topic we're focusing upon each week. For more information and to access the coaches video library, go to eCoachBasketball.com.
Thanks for listening. Make sure to join Jay each week for the Junior NBA Coaches Corner. Go to juniornba.com or wherever your favorite podcasts are found.